This week, excerpts from the 1976 Bilingual Bicultural Conference held in Anchorage, February the 25th, 26th, and the 27th. I'm Mo Osley, and welcome to Potlatch. Bernard Spolsky is professor of education at the University of New Mexico. He gave some background of bilingual education in America and some problems that are associated with it.
In a sense, what happened in the American picture since the First World War, during which a very strong fear and hatred of all foreigners developed, and therefore of all languages, was an approach that said, the only thing you need to know is one language. And seeing it's English here, everybody says, that's the language you have to know. Forget about everything else. When one looks at the effect of this policy, two very different but very important things happen. The first effect of the policy happens in the case of those groups that still continue to speak their own language with their own children. When their children come to school and school says, you should have known English before you came here, those children find it very hard to get a good education within the system. So the first problem that bilingual education is concerned with, and probably the one that is getting the major legal support at the moment, is saying that it's not legal to educate somebody in a language he or she doesn't understand. The first aim of bilingual education, then, for a group that still speaks its own language at home, is to make it possible for the children to be educated in their own language, all the time that they're learning English, the standard language. But it turns out that something much more complex happens beyond that. In the first stage, the main thing we're talking about is who has a right to education. We're saying even if somebody doesn't know English, they still have a right to it. Education. Education isn't just for the children of those people who speak English at home. That's the first stage. But a second kind of question gets opened up when we start dealing with that first question. As soon as we say anybody has a right to education, we have to make it possible for children to be educated in their own language. As soon as we start educating children in their own language, we start bringing into the schools teachers from the communities speaking those languages. As soon as we bring those people into the community, into the school, from the community into the school, they start asking some basic questions. And they start asking, what's education all about? What do we want our children to be when they grow up? Do we want them simply to speak English? Or do we want them to maintain something of our own cultural, ethnic, traditional background? And suddenly a whole new set of questions get asked. Questions not concerned with who is being educated, but why is anybody being educated? What sort of world are we going to live in? And this second question is the one that I think bilingual education is starting to become concerned with all over the world. Inevitably, in most kinds of bilingual programs, if the language is still widely used, the bilingual program will have the effect of leading to much more use of the standard language. Among the Navajo, it's very clear that there'll be continued increase in the use of English. as schools become more successful. And at that point, one of the most critical and difficult choices and difficult problems will be how well will the language, will Navajo, be maintained as English starts to be used more and more. Without a strong bilingual program, the likelihood is that it'll be much harder for the language to continue to be used. With a bilingual program, with the language being recognized in school, the language will have a much better opportunity to be maintained. For much of the world, the school is a fairly new and alien institution, introduced more or less during a period of Western colonization. While many communities had their own system of education, the school as we know it is a sort of single invention that spread over much of the world. And one of the most difficult problems is whether the school can be integrated into the community or whether it remains something quite alien. One of the most interesting and important effects of bilingual education has been to give the community a start on access to the school. As there are members of the community working in the school, so the community can go into the school and talk to the teachers, and talk to them in their own language, and start influencing the school. And thus, the school becomes an integrated part of the community and not an alien institution.
Let's send a task force down from Washington to check out their complaints. The Indians are unhappy and they're putting on the bait. They say their treatment is not fair and they blame the BIA. But you know you can't believe a single word the Redskins say. But you know you can't believe a single word the Redskins say. It's the very same old problem that we had 2 years ago. They want more programs started and the funds are getting low. We'll go down and ask some questions and just stand around a while. Then we'll make out our reports that we can later file. Then we'll make out our reports that we can later file. But it's got to become secret. No one should know that we're there. And all you have to do is tell them just what they want to hear. Send a task force down from Washington and check out their complaints. The Indians are unhappy, but is there a time when they ain't? Oh, the Indians are unhappy, but is there a time when they ain't? The Indians are unhappy, but is there a time when they ain't?
Floyd Westerman. Elaine Ramos, newly appointed Vice President for Rural Affairs with the University of Alaska, attended the conference and headed a self-determination panel discussion. She started with her experiences in the Alaskan bilingual movement.
We have worked in Tlingit and Tsimshian from the 69-70-71. Nora Dallenhauer did a fantastic job in the year she was down there, and was one of our first Tlingit language teachers. And through her, others were motivated, and we began to have as many as 30, 40 participants in Southeast Alaska. Pretty soon, we also had Haidas, and at the first workshop, we had 11, 12 Haidas. Then at the last workshop, we had 2 Tsimshians that were added to this. But the work throughout the whole state of Alaska has been fragmented. In 1972-73, then I went to Alaska Native Language Center as an administrator and tried to coordinate the language efforts throughout the state. And we then began the Copper River Native Language attempt there. And it was a real joy to go to Copper River. and meet Millie Buck and Virginia Pete and the rest of them who are now too doing a very fantastic kind of a job. And now what I would like to do from my new position is to give as much support to the Alaska Native language efforts as possible so that we can begin to coordinate and we can begin to do the kind of training that is needed now for Alaska Natives. And instead of giving a penny's help, to start giving a dollar's help. Instead of giving one person, let's now start giving two people that can help upgrade the Alaska Native language teachers and those that want to be the language linguists or those that want to be in an area where they can just write the legends. Self-determination has been a popular topic in Alaska, especially in the last 2 or 3 years before the introduction of Senate Bill 39. I remember when Bobby Clark and the rest of them came down to Jono 3 years ago to begin the fight so that there can be local determination, local control of the schools. It seemed like a fragmented effort at that time, but the movement began to move, and in no time at all there was an army in Jono lobbying with the legislatures. And I don't have to tell you the history that a year ago Senate Bill 39 was passed, and out of that now we've got the decentralization of the schools. Out of that now, if you are reading the papers, there is an election of those boards. But I feel that self-determination can really come about through education. We can get the legislatures to pass these laws so that we have the opportunity to help determine what education should be. But before you can do this, we have to train the school boards. Not only that, before bilingual education can really be successful, the Native people have to be trained. And I couldn't help but sit here and think that the people you've got here are really the cream of the crop. There's many of you sitting down there that are the experts in your language. And I love to pick on Peter Kalifornsky. He's a beautiful example of what a Native can do. He is 65 years old. He is beginning to be literate in his native language. He has learned to read and write. In other words, you're not too old. Chuck Natgon is sitting down here in front. He too can be the Haida expert. Millie Buck, and I can go on and on and on and pick the native people from the audience right now. And I think that is where self-determination comes. And you must unite together so that you can back these favorable legislation. You also must be involved enough to draft those legislation, because you've been talking about funding. Unless you are involved at this level, you don't get those funds. The other thing that I wanted to say was to just pick up on what Arnold Booth had to say. He said that his grandparents and his parents were determined that he would learn how to speak Tsimshian. If you are determined that you will revive your language or that there will be a continuation of your language, you have to be determined.
Yeah.
Buffy St. Marie. In a show-and-tell workshop, some teachers involved in bilingual education talked about their programs, demonstrated use of the language in the classroom, and sang in their native tongue.
One thing that I'm going to be working on, and I didn't realize what a task it was, the first thing I noticed when I started going around, I think the bilingual teacher is at a terrible disadvantage compared to the classroom teacher that's in that classroom, because they don't have any workbooks. That regular teacher just comes spelling time and she pulls out the spelling book. It comes science time and they pull out the science book. And here are these bilingual teachers there with nothing. You know, some materials have been developed in a workshop here or a workshop there. And then every day they have to imagine something and do it all on their own.
I enjoy teaching the children because I like to see them learn the language and the culture, because lots of people have been talking about it before. It's just not something that's, you know, we bring up as a second language. It's a shame that we have to do it. It should be a fresh language, but we're teaching it as a second language because the kids don't know it. The salmon is red. A simple sentence, you know, we don't make them too long. Because I think, I don't know how you feel about the Athabascan language, but I think it's the most hardest language. You know, even for myself, I'm a fluent speaker in Atna. But, you know, the first year I was trying to stress myself, I tried to teach the children, I got sore throated. Because it's mostly guttural. It's a sound that we use, you know. Or something like that. It's really hard. When I come home, I was telling the kids that my throat is sore. I think it's because I'm teaching Atna language, and then my kids would laugh about it. Then we teach them the numbers, A up to 10 for the beginners, because it's really hard, like I say. Some words are really long. Everyone students like the 10 because they like that sound, lazan. They say it's easy. They know that word. This is the hard one, chathakoli. Gistani, they like the word gistani because it's easy. You know, one day I made a mistake and picked up the book from Intasta and took it to school. And the children right away know that. How come the other day it was different and you bring a different number today? So kids are, they're smart, you know, they can catch you if you don't. The result of what you teach, it's just something that really makes me happy. When a child come up to me and talk to me in their own language. One day, about a few months after I taught, 1 6- or 7-year-old little boy come up and said, Mrs. Johns, do you know that the ya is red? You know, he got me puzzled. What is the ya is red? I don't know. Ya is sky, you know, sky in our language. He said, don't you know that the sky is red today? So that's, I really got a kick out of that because, you know, he was learning. I'd like to do a song for you that we do with the kids.
Night low and day, night low and day, eat and zap, eat and zap.
Katja, are you sleeping?
Then not dead mess of Kaida, eat the land would eat air. Nenje yaja kote se, cheste na dik el chinda.
There's one thing I'd like to say about that twinkle, twinkle, little star. We have to find words to put in because we don't have a word for diamond. So we put in a bright rock, twinkling rock. Just another is a twinkling rock.
We're going to sing a song for you. The Northern and Northwestern Inupiaq. And I wish you would, all of you Inupiaqs that know these songs, help us. The first one we're going to sing is Achagat. We notice that kids really enjoy singing, especially the younger ones. Here's one that is a half-breed song. It's part English and part Eskimo, and the name of it is Bishop Dog.
Bishop Dog means Gomorrah.
The next one is was taught to us by Tupo Kuru.
Umi Yura, Umi Yura, Darimi, Darimi, Darimi,
teachers. And the title of it in English is I'm a Little Teapot.
The next one is In the Cabin in the Woods.
I'm over Chamaru, Kriyaksha Sehoni, Kinyira Gali Chak, Kachak Tukini, Ika Yuma Niblipsu, Tukune, Tukak Tunga, Iserudi Nahina Lu.
In our final segment, Joe Coolidge with Kuskokwim Community College in Bethel closed the conference with a presentation on native language and culture.
I honestly respect the older natives, whether he's an Indian, Aleut, or Eskimo. They have a knowledge I don't have. They have a knowledge in their own culture. They know their culture. And if they didn't have a culture, they wouldn't have language. To have a language, you must have a culture. I was once a land in Alaska, and when I was born, I didn't have a language. And I didn't know what to say when I was born, because I didn't have a language. So I started listening to the wind that was blowing over me. It was making a whistling sound, which I can imitate. And I heard the water ripple. That was beautiful sound. And those were in the wilderness. And if you analyze the wilderness, it is wild. And it became wilder. And so now it's wilderness. And when I went to school, I went to school without a language. I was forced to learn the English, and I wasn't permitted to use my language in the classroom. I didn't know how to express myself in the classroom. I would have expressed myself better if I had a bilingual education at that time. But starting the school was like a new language to me. And I can see the educator's concerns. I thought that was the way to learn from the Gusak's point of view or the white man's point of view. They force you to learn. And that is my understanding right now. They are forceful. When I went to Mount Edgecombe, English teachers taught me how to speak English, but yet I was having difficult times trying to express myself in English. And up to this point, English is not my language. I wish everybody could understand my language. I could have made a better presentation. But I'm trying my best to get my views across to you so that you can understand me. And when I went to electronic school outside in Lower 48 under the Bureau of Indian Affairs, they made it up to me. I thought they made it up to me. I went to school there for a year and a half and worked for a year and a half. But I couldn't stand it out there. There were too many people. There was no wilderness.
I'm Mo Osley, and thank you for listening.
Potlatch is produced by KUAC under Title I of the Higher Education Act.